I had an opportunity yesterday to go up to Los Angeles and visit Hal Slafkin. Hal sends his regards to all of you. He's home, and he wishes that he could have joined us. So we have developed a hybrid, and my wish always was to be able to channel Hal Slafkin. As you all know, those of you that know him, his energy and his creativity is enormous. So with Hal's well wishes, let's begin. This is sort of a walk through a little bit of history and a walk up, I hope, to the current situation. So basically, you know, we're taking a look and we're posing a question to ourselves of how can we make oral health a higher priority? But depending on how we measure priorities, and especially national priorities, oral health or dental health could be viewed as being on the radar screen or off the radar screen. And so I thought we would sort of refresh by looking back a few years and seeing where oral health has been and how it has raised its head and its hand through the leadership of presidents, surgeons general, World Health Organization, and others. So in 1945, President Truman's proposed health program strongly included and integrated dental health into the children and maternal and child health program component. Obviously, the creation of the National Institute of Dental Research was visibility at a stage where only two other institutes were part of the National Institutes of Health, the Cancer Institute and the Heart Institute. Oral effects of tobacco use were highlighted in Luther Terry's report and at the Alma-Ata Declaration, where 138 countries came together to emphasize how important health was, health for all and health equity by the year 2000, included oral health. And in 79, Julie Richmond's landmark Surgeon General's report on health promotion disease prevention incorporated oral health. And Myron, I understand you had a lot to do with it at that time and, of course, launched and integrated us into the Healthy People 90, 2000, and then 2010, and now 2020. And then, of course, we all marched to the mantra of Surgeon General Koop and through the HIV/AIDS epidemic, this particular statement that he made famous and that we use often is a major statement that we have seen get a lot of visibility nationally. So moving us forward and framing the current oral health dialogue, I'm just highlighting some of these reports, and I will give a little bit of an overview of each of these. So for some of you that know these well, it is something that is a review. And for those of you that aren't familiar with them, it will give you just some highlights. So Healthy People 2010, where we are in this third wave and now starting the fourth wave of this national effort initiative on health promotion disease prevention, these particular health oral health objectives covered three categories as all the objectives were organized. So focusing on reducing oral diseases and conditions in an array of oral conditions, including oral cancer and tooth loss, making sure that we had measurements to deliver oral health services, focusing not only on the delivery of specific services, but community-based efforts, and opening up ourselves to interject dental examinations before school entry. And then increasing healthcare infrastructure and really highlighting the major need we have for enhancing the infrastructure related to oral health. But when we also looked at the larger picture, we saw that oral health was actually integrated throughout all these different areas as well. And that, in fact, I think covers over 100 objectives within this array of content areas shows the penetration and the integration of oral health across this very broad and visible national initiative. The Surgeon General's report was released just months after the 2010 objectives were released. And the charge was given to us not by the Surgeon General to develop this report, but by the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services at that time, Donna Shalala. And the important part of the charge was that it was to focus on issues related to oral health and the relationship of oral health to general health and well-being. It was not a focus on dentistry. And that was a very big distinction, because the call was to basically understand what and present what do we know, what do we do about it, and how can we move forward. And the team was, of course, a Californian, Kez Evans from then Los Angeles, myself, Bill Moss from CDC, and Hal Slafkin. And for those of you that know, this is just the tip of the iceberg team. There were hundreds of individual authors and reviewers and participants, and we had committees that related to the authors and reviewers. We have authors and reviewers here in the room today. But also we had a trans-federal committee that oversaw the report, and we were fortunate to have the leadership on the Friends of the report that brought our professional organizations and groups together. The report was organized to answer 5 questions, and it wasn't why is this night different than any other night, but it did pose the questions so that the answers would be provided to those who did not know what oral health is, did not know what the magnitude of the problem was. And we realized later on that this structure was very informative and helpful, especially within the first circle of communication audiences, one being our fellow healthcare professionals that were non-dental, and then moving on to public and policymakers, of course. So the messages that came through the report were clearly that oral diseases and conditions affect health and well-being from early on throughout the lifespan, that there are ways, and this was very different than most Surgeon General's reports that really didn't have interventions, that there are safe and effective ways to prevent the most common oral diseases and conditions. There was a but there, but that there were individuals and populations that did not benefit from these available preventive measures. Lifestyle behaviors, and at this time the health determinants was a big thrust, were also affecting oral diseases and conditions as they do other conditions. And we did note major oral health disparities, and looking at obviously this connection between general health and well-being. And Myron's key statement was also highlighted here, the issue of this silent epidemic. We had concurrently a report that came out on mental health that focused on issues related to parity of mental health. We wanted to use parity in oral health as well, but the competition at the headquarters at the Secretary's Department gave that term to mental health. We got silent epidemic. So, there's different ways to take a look at it. But the issue really is parity, stigma, and silent epidemic. And here, the bottom line was that we weren't, using the tools we already had to make a difference in everybody's oral health. The associations were highlighted across oral infections and all of these diseases and conditions. In many places, this was just the beginning of the associations. We were looking at very early findings, pilot studies at that time. But even so, the diversity of these associations was impressive to those that didn't know very much about oral infections and their relationship to general health. And then fast facts emerged that we used and incorporated in terms of the frequency and the magnitude of the problems that covered the full range of oral and craniofacial conditions, issues related with the most common birth defect, cleft lip and palate, issues related to the magnitude of oral cancer and the way it affects individuals, pain, injuries to the face and mouth, and also the depths of dental insurance. The dental caries, and I'll now focus a few slides on dental caries themselves, this statement of making a relative comparison to asthma was an important one, and is still to today. We have those discussions in groups that are promulgating and needing to address issues related to asthma prevention and management. But the fact that we have a condition that's facing our children that has this much of a magnitude for something that can be prevented was highlighted. And so these are just examples of what you've all seen. Some of you have maybe not seen the dimensions of this particular form of early childhood caries, which is very aggressive, rampant, and devastating. And the impact on children in terms of pain, in terms of the effect of loss of time from school, not only for the children, clearly for the families as well. We're learning about the effect of pain on cognition and ability to concentrate for children and adults, and on their ability to sleep. Infections here, again, Hal wanted to highlight the effect of these infections on a broad range of general conditions, from failure to thrive and delayed growth patterns, to the magnitude of the oral microbial flora and the roles that that plays. In fact, there's a recent paper that just came out to look at the causes of the oral flora and bacteremia as it results after tooth extraction, and it's a phenomenal spread of infection that's possible. And tooth infections, and they're obviously there, the causes through bacteremia for bacterial meningitis, and as we've seen recently, and I'll get to that, even more serious outcomes. But the bottom line is that the fact that this is an infectious disease at onset, the first step has to take place of transmission from caregiver to child, but it is preventable. And it's that statement that is a major loss, and one if we don't act on it as a nation and obviously as a profession. And that we're looking and still learning about the timing of transmission, but there also are occurrences of these infectious agents and Streptococcus mutans prior to tooth eruption as well. So we're learning about the variations. The discrepancy between the prevalence, and this is the old slide from the Surgeon General's report, but way back in 1996, the picture is the same, though, of the higher percent of individuals with untreated decayed teeth in the poor versus the non-poor, but these are still very high percents. Surgeon General Carmona released in 2003 a national call to action to promote oral health, and this was actually as a follow-up on the Surgeon General's report because it called for setting up a national framework, and it was set up in a way that allowed for actions to be taken. And these particular actions that were part of the call focused on changing perceptions to oral health, changing those perceptions for the public, for health professions, and for the policymakers, with a focus on health literacy, overcoming barriers by looking at best practices and moving them forward, building on our science base and moving it forward, a focus on increasing our workforce diversity, but also our flexibility in our workforce and in our capacity, and finally increasing collaborations. So this created a very large agenda for us, and I wanted to spend a little bit of time, and I could actually, we could all, if we were to go around the room, list 30,000 things that have occurred. I wanted to say that the work that has been done at all levels of government, in academia, in professional organizations, at state levels has been incredible in terms of addressing oral health and following up on the call to action and the Surgeon General's report. A few of them include infrastructure building. We have had summits for the state dental Medicaid directors, and actually the creation for the first time of a brand new association of dental Medicaid directors. The state infrastructure grants that CDC has funded and continues to fund and expand upon. The Dental Data Resource Center, that's a collaboration to provide those data available from CDC and from NIDCR. The ASTDD best practices, the systematic reviews that evolved as part of the Community Preventive Services Task Force, the policy centers that exist, and the Maternal and Child Health Oral Health Research Centers, the work that has been done in California here with the foundation. I mean, the infrastructure statements, the digestion of the data, the presentation of the problems has been incredible. From a research point of view, I'm really pleased this afternoon and tomorrow that we're going to hear from the Centers for Research to Reduce Oral Health Disparities. That was a major initiative, along with the statewide models for early detection and prevention of oral cancer, and clinical trials galore. Workforce development, I think we had the foundations coming in with Robert Wood Johnson, with the California Endowment, with J&J, in order to get our students out in the community. We've had the development of community health aides, dental health aides, therapists, promotoras, patient navigators. You know, we have seen a renaissance in this whole area of new approaches to enhancing the workforce. And expansion into partner healthcare professions. I was at the American Academy of Pediatrics meeting the other day for their very specific oral health session, a 5-hour, Amos, you were there, 5-hour session on oral health. I think there were 700 pediatricians sitting glued in their seats from 12 o'clock to 5 o'clock going through Oral Health 101. And fluoride varnishes, and excited residents in pediatrics taking this as their primary area. So these are, I think, successes. The partnerships and public health leadership that HRSA has shown, and we'll talk about that a little bit later with HCFA and the collaboration with Head Start. The role of the patient groups and family voices and ectodermal dysplasia and their presence on the Hill in the states. We could just go on and on. So I think the work to get the visibility is there. Why aren't we doing it? This is just highlighting one Wusong. You have to see this picture. Only one of the centers I'm highlighting, because these centers have moved into so many new areas. And Ahmed, I see in the back. These centers have moved into so many new areas, expanding both the new approaches to our science, in this case with neighborhood analysis, but also in being able to bring new light and understanding to health disparities and how we could manage them. And more facts emerge, but what we did see was, while there were good things happening, positive movements, increased infrastructure, we were seeing a problem emerging, and especially as shown in terms of the increase in disease among our very young children. And the progress report for 2010 showed that 28% of our young kids had early childhood caries. Only 16% of our lower SES children received preventive dental services. We saw parents were 3 times more likely to report that their children's dental needs were unmet as compared to medical care, and that we saw a very large number of children without dental insurance. And then Diamante Driver passed away, 12-year-old boy due to an infection caused by a tooth abscess, and the series of events opened up. It opened up on the Hill with legislation that was put forth. It opened up within our state where we live at Maryland with our secretary who called for a dental action committee. And other cases such as this came out of the woodwork. We were fortunate to have a very engaged and active health correspondent for the Washington Post, Mary Otto, who highlighted numerous times this very major issue and raised the fact that Diamante Driver was one example of many when we take a look at a problem and problems that we have in the system or non-systems. And having senior level policymakers like Elijah Cummings from our state say in public that dental decay is the single most common childhood disease, and I will not relent in this fight until I'm assured that every single child who needs to see a dentist is able to do that. These are the kind of emotions that were raised and brought forth in the months and currently as well following this untimely death, unnecessary death. And Diamante's Law, as it is now called and is now being looked at critically, is highlighting, and actually in our Maryland State report, these are very similar areas that are being called for. But if you take a look at some of these areas, it's to expand dental services broadly within our existing federally qualified health centers, to follow up on the pilot programs for testing models of allied health, dental health. We are doing that, but we probably need to do more and tailor it a little more locally. Tax credits have been discussed on and off in the profession. It was added into this bill. Making sure that we have funds to support public education and a prevention campaign, and that cannot be overemphasized. Taking a look at accountability of reports of states on issues related to access, and making sure that we interdigitate and coordinate our programs, as well as looking at adequacy of our reimbursement and providing grants, in this case, to enhance our pediatric dentistry capacity, but at our state is to enhance the pediatric capacity of general practitioners and a broader array and open up the door to dental hygienists to be able to do more. So at the local level, you're seeing different pictures. And if we were to look back over these years as well, in the 8 years since the report, we'll see other events that brought to the fore oral health issues. Oral diseases were one of the top reasons why deployment was postponed for our troops. Obviously, at the Iraqi war, we have seen a lot of that. 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina also highlighted major needs in oral health as well. So when we take a look at the magnitude of the problem, it's important to always take a look at the costs. And these are some of the costs that have been projected. But if you look at 2016, dental expenditures are projected to reach $163 billion. Even though we stay at sort of a common proportion of all national health expenditures, is still a lot of money, but this does not take into account when people are off to hospitals or other places where costs are incurred. So, one aspect of looking at where we go to the future is to integrate ourselves within the context of the movement in various areas, and one large movement, one large call by both the Institute of Medicine report as well as by the Surgeon General, Rich Carmona, was health literacy, which is essential to oral health. And health literacy overall, if you take a look at the definitions, basically speaks to the importance of having individuals access information, process it, and then use it appropriately to make decisions, receive services. It's actually more complex than that. It includes not only the individual, it includes the ability of providers to be able to provide that information in an appropriate manner. It speaks to the system, it speaks to cultural competency and more. So, already documented is when people have limited health literacy skills, they have a lower use of preventive services, including fluoride toothpaste, as well as other services, higher use of treatment services, which result obviously in higher costs, and they may also feel uncomfortable and have a sense of shame about their skill level. And who's at risk? If you take a look at this, these are our vulnerable populations. And these are ones that we will be focusing on as well. So the oral health literacy framework, which provides an opportunity for us to work with a broader health literacy movement, includes all of these components from our education system, our health system, our culture and society, with ultimately increased outcomes in oral health, but also increased outcomes in health overall. One of the reports that came out of the University of Connecticut School of Business most recently estimated that the cost of low health literacy to this nation is in excess of $100 billion. And so this is probably a low assessment. Linking health literacy, obviously, to families and communities is a key aspect. And in many ways, none of this is new. I mean, this has been said over and over and over again. But we're talking on one side about enhancing our team, our dental team, by having new members, enhancing our capacity to work in the community. We've got every person and every mother and father and every caregiver available that does not have the information to do some very basic things that could really enhance our capacity, not just for oral health prevention and management, but for health overall. And so one area of engaging the public is the public as providers, the public as educated consumers. That's like Sims and any other place where you can, if the best customer is an educated consumer. But also engaging the public so they could be the ones that speak to the need for the care that they need, for the prevention that they need, rather than those of us who look like very biased individuals. And this particular diagram came from the IOM report from Neurons and Neighborhoods with some embellishment from a workshop that was held at the University of Southern California in 2006. But it highlights again this whole series of areas that we have to consider moving from the individual onto the broader community and then into the policy arena. And within this construct, I think we're seeing movements across all health areas, and oral health needs to be part and parcel of that. So Hal has named oral health as the canary in the coal mine. And this particular example is the Diamante driver example. You know, when we see something like that happen, that should not happen, should never happen in this country, or any other country, we're seeing a whole system breakdown, and we have to start asking some series of questions of what we can do, and it's not just oral health. So how can we make oral health a much higher priority? Hal's mantra is integrate. He has always been a great integrator, and so his recommendation is to integrate oral health within the context of school health, from preschool all the way through, integrating oral health within the training of the primary health professions and prenatal care and WIC, for example. I'm calling for integrating oral health into public health training. We've got all these people going for MPHs and their DRPH and their PhDs, and there is no oral health course or concepts being taught for them. And they're going to be policy leaders, and they're going to be faculty members and advocates for public health. Health literacy, health promotion, disease prevention, maybe there's a cluster effect that if we lock elbows with mental health and hearing and with vision, we could get some momentum so we are not isolating ourselves. Moving forward in terms of a community level interaction and goals for sustainable life and integrating with other ways in which to develop social capital and safe communities would be useful. And then this whole issue of health and social determinant initiatives, which are different. You know, health determinants versus the social determinants, I think we have some different strategies that need to be taken into account. So this is either the melon or the glass, but the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on how you look at it. And on one side, I'd like to say that there has been a fabulous job done in giving visibility to oral health, that there is movement being made. Maybe the time frame we're looking at is less than a speck of sand in the years and decades that we will be watching this. On the other hand, we're not integrated. We're not always at the table. We are looked at as something that is on the side. And so there still needs to be leadership and commitment. And when you take a look at where programs are moving forward, it's the leaders. It is the leaders. It comes down to the person, the individual who plays a role and makes it happen. And we just have to make sure we invest in the development of our future leaders and we give them the ammunition that they need. So Hal has come to this end in his presentation, and I wanted to add a few things from some lessons learned from most recently, The Lancet had a series of articles on the 30 years anniversary of Alma Ata, and there were things that were learned in these past 30 years of what worked and what didn't work, and I thought that for our discussion, some of these would be useful. As I said earlier, this Alma Ata Declaration was in 1978. It was a commitment of 138 countries for health for all in the year 2000, and a statement of values that inadequate and unequal health care was unacceptable economically, socially, and politically. And some of the lessons that have been stated as learned during this process were, the one was community participation and partnership, which was a major component of Alma Ata, was not as successful. It was seen when it was transpired into countries and communities as a much slower, less controllable approach. And it also led to conflict with the professions. I think we can understand some of that grassroots efforts take time. They may not be as easy. And it's easier to silo in and do an immunization program alone than work within the context of the community. Secondly, community workers. At the time Alma Ata was passed, there was actually a decrease in the use of community workers. And there were inconsistent links of those community workers. These were more barefoot doctors, promotoras type individuals. There was an inconsistent link to the health system, and the importance and the lessons learned are to link these workers that we develop today to families and communities and to the system overall. If they're not linked, if they're not supervised, if they're not encouraged, they won't play a role. They'll be seen as second level. Thirdly was health information, and the health information that was needed and was recommended was to have it be local as possible. Fourth was intersectoral action. And this is something that we talk about when we talk about social determinants and intersectoral action. The issue that they came against, and they're studying the various countries and looking across education and social services, was that each of these sectors had their own priorities. They had their own barriers, their own needs. And so trying to move across was very difficult, even though there were potential gains. But even health personnel forget about the potential of public health gains possible from non-health interventions. And I think that's something that we have to keep thinking about. And finally, indicators they felt was needed, not just for outcomes, health outcomes, but for process, because it does take time and you need some reinforcement through that. So with that, I thank you. Hal thanks you for letting me channel him here, and I look forward to the next presentation.